That gavel's a little weak. You got to be strong with it. Let's call the House Special Committee on Energy to order. It's 10:16 on Tuesday, February 28th. Members present are Vice Chair Sponholt, Representative Klayman, Representative Johnson, Representative Johnston, Representative Rauscher, and myself, Chair Wall. We do have a quorum to conduct business, so please turn off your cell phones. Today we'll be hearing a presentation on the history and the current state of the Rail Belt electric utilities, and we may have time to go into a couple other issues at the end of the presentation with questions. We have on the line Chairman Bob Pickett from the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, otherwise known as the RCA. So he was unable to join us down here due to budget constraints, but he's on the line with us. I kind of wanted him here in the room. I keep hearing about the RCA for years, and now we get to talk to someone who's on the RCA, and I recognize that Representative Westlake is here now, too. And we may have some other people online as well. I don't see them on just yet, but we may have Jay Lane, engineering analyst, and Bernie Smith, engineering manager, both available for questions. So maybe by the time we get to questions, they will be online. We have the PowerPoint presentation in your packet. Also the letter dated June 30th, 2015, from the RCA to the legislature that includes recommendations for railboat utilities, and a January 30th, 2017 letter to the RCA with the power pooling attachment agreement attached. So those are the documents you should have, and we have till noon for this meeting, and I believe there's a lot to cover, so I will not talk any longer. And if you have any questions or communication for the committee, do so through Rob Earl, the committee staff. And with that, I will turn it over to Bob Pickett. Are you there, Bob?
Yes, I am here, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to do this presentation before the House Energy Committee. I'm sorry I cannot be in Juneau in person, but due to the extremely heavy workload we have and budgetary constraints and just a lot of things pulling at our time, it was not possible to do that. So is the PowerPoint presentation on your screen at this point?
Yep, we're all queued up.
Okay, well, I will go through it, and feel free to interrupt me. I do have a series of questions that Rob Earl did present to me yesterday, and we can answer those at the end, or if you would rather do it during the presentation, that's fine also.
With that. Okay, yeah, we'll interrupt if need be, and we'll definitely have questions at the end.
Okay. Well, go to slide two. Just in terms of a little bit of background information, the RCA does regulate 600 certificated utilities and pipelines, and it covers a very wide range of industry groups, including small water and wastewater systems, some trash removal systems, large telecommunication companies, electric companies, natural gas, and we also concurrently with the FERC regulate the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And our charge from the legislature is to ensure that there is reliable utility and pipeline service with just and reasonable rates. We also have involvement with some other programs. We jointly with the Alaska Energy Authority administer the Power Cost Equalization Program. One other program that's not on your slide but we do have involvement with is the Alaska Universal Service Fund for telecommunications, helping to levelize the playing field and ensuring intrastate long-distance calls are available throughout the state. The governing statutes, I won't go into a lot of detail, but there's essentially five different sections of Alaska statutes that authorize the RCA to do what it does. The most recent addition to our statutes was the development of AS 4208, in-state pipeline contract carrier, which was enacted in 2013, and that was largely for the in-state large diameter natural gas pipeline and for other contract carriers. Before that, our pipeline statutes were dealing with common carrier pipelines only. You go to the third slide, and I apologize if it's a little bit small font, but what it's doing is just giving you in the rail belt And later in the presentation, I will be having some comments on other areas of the state and the electric system, but the primary focus of this presentation is the Rel Health electrical system. And this gives you an idea, if you look at the lower sort of purple color, that's the former Electric Association service area. Seward is a little bit to the right of that. They purchased power from Chugach Electric. And Chugach Electric and Municipal Light and Power are the blue and small red area in the middle part of that slide. And Matanuska Electric is the yellow area that goes up towards Cantwell and then over towards Eureka. And then Golden Valley Electric is at the far north part of the slide, covering a fairly extensive area, both sides of Fairbanks down to North Pole and then over to the area just north of Cantwell. The fourth slide.
May I ask a question?
We have a question. Bob, we have a question from the committee.
Capacity.
Hey, Bob?
As of 2016.
Hey, Bob, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, we have a question from Representative Johnson.
Sure, go ahead.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question on slide 3, where you have the colored areas for the different service areas. Is that actual service area provided or where they provide service, or is that their service area boundaries?
That is the certificated, you know, when we issue a CPCN or a Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity, part of that process is a defined service area. Now, doesn't that mean that service is available in every corner of that colored area or service area? No, it is subject to line extension policies and other things of that nature, but that is where they're authorized to do business.
So,
follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the highlighted areas are their where they have their service area boundaries. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And then my next part of that then is, so that central area between Golden Valley and Matanuska Electric, is there any kind of agreement as to where that middle boundary would be? We just don't have any service between those two areas.
Just utility in that area at this point.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr.
Thanks.
Chair.
Representative Rusher.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair. You have Copper Valley and then MEA, and they meet together. Just where do they meet together right there? Do you have any idea?
I don't.
I think it's up in the Eureka area generally, in that type of area up there.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and I have a quick question. Bob, is the there's green. Green represents Seward, but then there's a bunch of green lines going from, looks like downtown Anchorage. Is that another use of the color green, or is that also Seward?
Well, I think what it's indicating, the green is, through the chair, I apologize, is a transmission line. Mm-hmm. If you look at the blue area over on the other side of the inlet, that's where the Beluga power plants are. And the three green lines are the high voltage transmission lines that Chugach has. And the same, if you go to the sewer area, those green areas represent transmission going down to the sewer area.
Okay, thank you.
And you're connecting with the HEA system.
Okay, I got it. Thank you. We have one more question here from Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to get this clear. So the green transmission lines are controlled by Chugach?
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, you can proceed.
Through the chair, if you would all turn to slide 4, the Rel Health installed generation capacity in megawatts as of 2016. By utility, you can see that the size of the system we're talking about in the Rel Belt is relatively small in terms of megawatt generation. When you compare it to systems outside, for example, there are singular power plants that produce more than 1,839 megawatts. And so the largest at this point in terms of megawatt capacity is Chugach Electric, followed by MLMP, Golden Valley Electric, and Then we get into MEA and Home Electric, roughly the same size. And at the bottom of that is a bar graph representation of the various generation assets, and then it totals it on the far right. So before I go on to the next slide, are there any questions?
Yes, there are. Representative Johnston has a question.
Yes, thank you. This is Representative Johnston. And I have a couple of questions about this graph. First of all, I noticed that you have the 120 megawatt from Plant 2A, but will increase MLMP. Will it increase it beyond the 407 megawatt?
Mm-hmm.
And then as you're looking at this, what have you done as far as the power generation from Beluga? Because as MLMP comes on and you have the SPP there with Chugach Electric, Beluga should be dropping. Is that correct?
This is capacity.
Okay. So you still have the Beluga capacity there?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. My next question is as far as capacity and Bradley Lake capacity. So you're just talking about capacity and not talking about power generation to the railroad. What is the ultimate? I know we got kind of a bottleneck there at Bradley Lake. What can actually go from Bradley Lake into the system as far as capacity?
As far as I'm going to see it, Bernie Smith, do you have the specific factor that can come up from Bradley Lake onto the Chugach system at this point? It's approximately 75 megawatts of power can come from Bradley Lake up through the system. It can go a little higher, but it's not, it hurts the transmission line to go much more than 75 megawatts. So right now there is a bottleneck of getting the power from Bradley up to Anchorage and beyond, but it's what it is right now.
So as we look at the Bradley Lake capacity from MLMP or for Chugach, they definitely don't get the transmission of megawatts from Bradley, but is it prorated out as to each utility as far as the capacity, as far as what they get that can come off from Bradley?
The Bradley Lake agreements are the governing document for this, and the legislature has specifically excluded the RCA from overseeing any aspect of the Bradley Lake agreements. So we do work with Chugach on the Chugach transmission revenue requirements, so there's a bit of a tension there, and in fact there's litigation with the various utilities at this point that is yet to be resolved, so we've got to be somewhat cautious about how we talk about it.
Thank you.
Okay, no more further questions at this point. You guys can go on.
Okay, and for the record, I apologize to the chair. That was Bernie Smith, the head of our engineering department, who answered the question. On slide five is the Riverside Utilities peak load, looking at the period of time 2010 through 2015. And this is megawatt hours per year, a little different metric than what you saw on the capacity. And it's in two parts. You have a table at the top by utility, by year, and then you go to the bottom and you'll see a graphic depiction of those same numbers. And it can be a little bit confusing because I think what needs to be brought out at this point is we had some fairly significant changes in the Rail Belt commercial agreements in 2013 and 2014. In 2013, that was the year that, at the end of the year, Homer Electric was no longer an all requirements power purchaser from Chugach Electric, which was the historic legacy agreement. They began self-generating at that point. And then the following year, at the end of the year, Matanuska Electric was at the end of their long-term power purchase agreement from Chugach Electric, and they began self-generating. And so, if you look, say, go to the 2013 graph where you see at the top a peak load of 5420, that includes a couple of increments towards the bottom of that with HEA and MEA, in which they were purchasing their load from Chugach. So that was, you know, sort of part of that 5420. Fast forward to 2015, then you look at Chugach's native load had dropped to 2620. The rest of the loads are fairly stable, but that drop is largely a reflection of the fact that Homer Electric and Metanoosa Electric no longer purchase wholesale power from Chugach Electric. All in all, the load for the rail belt has been relatively stable for that 5-year period. So are there any questions on this graph before I proceed?
Nope, don't see any.
Excuse me.
Question from Representative Johnston.
I'm sorry. So as we go from the generation capacity, is that daily, monthly?
The capacity is, you know, what if you have that generator running or all the generators running on the railroad, that's how many megawatts you could generate.
Mm-hmm.
Nameplate capacity.
Okay. And then the next slide is what the peak loads are. I'm just wanting to make sure I have this correct.
Yeah.
Thank you.
What the next slide does is it throws the time metric into it, not just the capacity and how much you're generating, but how much per hour over the course of the year.
Thank you.
We'll now move on to slide 6. Which is Metanoosa Electric Association service area. Their CPCN number 18, they're serving 63,000 customers. And if you look at a little bit better idea as to their service boundaries, a little more detail there. If you move to slide 7, this deals with Metanoosa Electric's equipment generation statement, which is referred to as the EGS. This came online in 2015 after the conclusion of their long-term power purchase agreement with Chugach Electric. It's located in Aquidneck. It's a 171-megawatt natural gas power plant. A little bit different than the approach that some of the other electric utilities, most of the electric natural gas generation is combined cycle aeroderivative units. The EGS has 10 Wärtsilä generators, 17 megawatts each, which are reciprocating. And this came in at a cost of about $334 million. Are there any questions on the equipment generating station slide before I move on?
Yeah, we have a question from Representative Johnston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it says that only 40% of the engines are online, and I actually heard a little bit about that. What's currently online?
No, they're all available at this point. There was just a slight delay, no big deal, in the first quarter of 2015, in which they had to extend some of the commercial agreements with Chugach Electric, because, you know, commissioning just takes a little bit of time to do it, but they're all available for generation at this point.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rauscher.
Yeah. Through the chair, this NEA and Copper Valley, even though they meet, you say, somewhere at Eklutna, there's no connectivity, is there?
That would actually be Eureka.
I'm sorry, I apologize for you. Yeah, Eureka. There's no connectivity, is there? In other words, they can't transfer electric either way through each other, right?
No, there's really no transmission interconnectivity between the two utilities. It's basically an extension of distribution lines, which don't have the capacity to transmit significant volumes of power.
And then you know, the same thing with Golden Valley. There's no connectivity anywhere, right?
You have the Alaska Intertie, which is, you know, partly state funded, and Golden Valley has some transmission assets. So there is transmission of electric energy from the southern part of the rail belt up to Golden Valley, and potentially the other direction if market conditions were such that made sense.
Okay, thank you,
Representative Kleinman.
Thank you, through the chair. And this may be more a question for somebody else to answer, but Do you know the reason why MEA elected to use what I would generally describe as somewhat small, 10 smaller generator, smaller capacity generators, while the other utilities seem to like to go bigger? Is there a reason for that, if you know?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, those types of decisions, the RCA does not have siting authority, and we'll get into that in some other parts. So it's that's a utility management decision, and I can speculate perhaps, but I mean, the way it has sort of worked out is there is, given where that generation is located on the system, there is an advantage to having the ability to dispatch in 17 megawatt increments. When you have an aero derivative unit of, say, 60 megawatts, you get the most efficient generation, you get it running, and you get it within its operating parameters, and you leave it running. You don't dial it up and down and up with dramatic fluctuations. And so, in a sense, the EGS increments are probably better suited to step up and step down in some circumstances.
Thank you.
Are there any more questions on slide 7?
No, I think we're good.
We'll now go to slide 8, which is Chugach Electric Association. They have CPCN number 8. And I am going to offer a little bit of a clarification. We were contacted by Bill Stoddard at Chugach Electric. These figures that you're seeing reflected on your slides are from annual reports. And though Chugach has 69,000 customers, they do have 83,000 meter customers. So meaning, say, an individual customer might have several different sites that they have meters. So just for the record, I think we told Bill that we'd get that out there. If you go to slide 9, that's the South Central Power Project. That's a joint project between Chugach Electric and Municipal Light and Power. So it's three natural gas turbines, one steam turbine with 200 megawatts of total capacity. This did project cost was $359 million. They did come in under budget and a little bit ahead of schedule on January 31st, 2013. And again, it was a joint effort between Municipal Light and Power and Chugach Electric, which I think represented a very positive movement forward in terms of cooperation and coordination in the Rail Belt Electric System. Any questions on slide 9?
I have a question. When you listed the different utilities and their different generation capacities, how is this one factored in since it's a joint?
It's MLMP has a 30% ownership, and you get just a 70, and we prorated it that way.
Okay, so it's one power plant with different output attributions. Okay, thank you.
Any more questions on slide 9?
I think we're good.
If you move to slide 10, this is an overview of the Beluga power plant. Historically, for all practical purposes, the Beluga power plant powered the southern part of the Rail Belt until fairly recently. And you can see there are a number of different units with different capacities. When SPP, or the South Central Power, came on with 200 megawatts of capacity, the other units started to be dialed back and put into various states of retirement. And that's sort of an ongoing process that when Chugach files rate cases with the commission, they put a proposal out, and when they update their depreciation studies, it deals with those types of issues. This was located because the Beluga gas fields were the source of fuel for a significant part of the electric generation for decades, and it just made sense to put the plant there and, you know, install the high voltage transmission line interconnecting Anchorage with the plant and the rest of the southern part of the Rail Belt. Questions on slide 10 before I move on?
Don't see any.
Through Chair, you should now have slide 11 with Anchorage Municipal, Municipality Lawton Power, MLMP, CPCN 121 with 31,000 customers. It covers the, you know, sort of the core urban part of Anchorage with their little section out there covering the power generation facilities. MLMP has Plant 2A, which is just in the, it's just been coming online and being fully commissioned. It consists of 120 megawatts. It's a combined cycle natural gas power generation. That's two LM6000 aeroderivative generators, one steam unit, and the cost is over $275 million, and it was starting up in the towards the end of 16 and in the first quarter of 17. And I can't say a lot about this. MLMP has filed a rate case with us and another intervener, so if I sound like I'm dodging questions, that's the reason. So are there any questions on slide 12?
I have a question. Is this, it says starts up first quarter 2017, so I'm guessing it's not online yet.
No, it is online. It's just, you know, the commissioning process takes a little bit of time, and, you know, you got to work out the final warranty details with your contractor and all of that kind of stuff. So it's not an instantaneous thing where you just flip the switch and one day you're offline and the next day you're online. But they were actually generating power towards the end of 16.
Okay, thank you.
Any more questions on slide 12?
Nope.
We'll now move on to slide 13, which is Homer Electric Association, CPCN 32, with 30,000 customers on the western side of the Kenai Peninsula, essentially. And at this, Homer Electric's wholesale power agreement with Chugach Electric ended at the end of 2013. They took sort of a multi-phase approach to generate their own power. They've got a steam turbine in conjunction with a natural gas turbine that produces 80 megawatts. And that cost of that, this is the Nikiski plant, was $95 million. Other generation assets they have with the Soldotna combustion turbine, which they spent $77.5 million. And the Bernese combustion turbine, which is 16.4, totaling about $187 million. Any questions on the HEA level on slide 14? Moving on to slide 15. So we do not, in a regulatory sense, have jurisdiction over the Bradley Lake power. This is just an informational slide for you. It's a 120 megawatt hydro plant with 260 megawatt generators. It is completed since 1991, September. And it was a total cost of $328 million shared by six rooftop utilities that each took a different percentage flowing to the power. And coupled with that, slide 15 is slide 16, which articulates what those Bradley Lake exemptions are concerning RCA regulation. I won't go into a lot of detail on that unless the committee members have a question on slide 16.
Yep, Representative Johnston.
What would happen, thank you to the chair, what would happen if there were some additional transmission lines from Bradley Lake? Would that bring in RCA, or would that still be separate?
It would, to the extent that they would be asking for recovery of cost of the transmission lines in rates, a certificated utility would have to come to the RCA to be able to include that in rates. Now, the challenging part is, again, I'm not going to say a lot because there's litigation that is currently in the court system with the various Bradley Lake utilities, and I don't think it'd be appropriate for me to speculate on what the outcome of that might be.
Thank you.
Representative Johnston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just a general question on RCA in general. Is there, I know when it comes to certain utilities, if it was, sometimes they're not regulated if they existed at statehood. Is that the case with any electrical or power generating facilities at all? Or, and if it is are any of those contributing to any rail belt power that you're not really specifically speaking to?
As far as unregulated entities?
Yes.
I may have misunderstood the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is any power facilities not under the RCA, is there any way that they can be opted out, not necessarily opted out, but that they were never, they're kind of not grandfathered out in a sense from RCA oversight? Power facilities.
In the rail belt that you would see, there are a couple of things I'll put out there. The legislature specifically exempted Fire Island and Fire Island Wind, though not by name, but by how the language was structured, from not being under RCA cost of service regulation. And that project entered into a long-term power purchase agreement with Chugach Electric to be able to get the financing and have the, you know, long-term guarantees of a power purchaser. We looked and approved the actual power purchase agreement between Chugach, the regulated entity, and Fire Island Wind. Chugach essentially brought that contract before the commission for its consideration. In another case, up in Fairbanks and Dulles Junction, there is an entity that is certificated by its Delta Wind, and we certificated it and put a capacity limit on the certificate of 2 MW, but they entered into a long-term agreement with Golden Valley Electric. So those are probably the, you know, independent power producers. If they they may not be regulated in terms of cost of service as the entity itself, but for a long-term contract, the RCA would be looking at that between the certificated utility and that IPP.
All right, thank you.
Representative Johnson mentioned something that triggered a thought for me, which was opting out, and I think recently Homer Electric had a vote to opt out of RCA regulation. Is that,
yes,
is that a concern, or is that a common thing, or is that a, what are your thoughts on that, to the extent that you can comment on that?
We've had smaller co-ops in rural parts of the state that have opted out. This was the first major rail belt opt out, and the HEA co-op members voted it down by well in excess of 70%, electing to stay within the RCA oversight.
Okay. I guess my question is, your job is to regulate utilities, and if a utility, they can obviously choose not to be regulated. Certain co-ops can. Is that the condition?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. You can proceed.
Anything else on slide 16 before I proceed?
No, I think we're good.
Slide 17 is Golden Valley Electric Association service area, CPC and 13, with 40,000 customers. And again, you can see they have a rather sprawling service area stretching from up to Fairbanks and north a little bit, and then down to the Delta Junction area. Slide 18 details their North Pole Expansion Power Plant of 60 megawatts, which was completed in March of 2007 at a cost of $100 million. And PetroStar put in a 600-foot pipe to supply a naphtha blended fuel by July of 2016 with the closure of Flint Hills. And this generator can actually be fueled by natural gas if natural gas does become available in Fairbanks. Any questions on slide 18? Hearing none. I'll move on to slide 19, which is Golden Valley Cedar Creek Wind Farm. And this is a little under 25 megawatts of 12 wind turbines. They're more than 400 feet tall, based at the blade tip. And this project had a cost of $93 million and was commissioned January 7th of 2013. And this is over in the Healy area. Any questions on slide 19?
Nope.
Slide 20 is the Healy Unit 2 coal plant. This plant has a long history, and we've tried to detail it as accurately as we can with the current state. And it started with a sort of a demonstration, U.S. Department of Energy clean coal technology for Healy Clean Coal. It was funded, you know, from the utility, the state, and the federal government. It began burning coal in 1998. But it actually failed in 1999 and went into a bit of a hibernation period for a number of years. Ultimately, and not that long ago, Golden Valley paid $44 million for the plant, and they've got more than $300 in construction costs associated with it, which totals about $447 million. Its name was changed in 2012 to Healy Unit 1, Healy Unit 2. Healy 1 is a small 25 megawatt coal plant that's been in operation for many decades. The purchase from ADA by Golden Valley was completed in December 2013, and they had a commissioning incident in March 3rd of 2016 with a fire and an explosion, and it is expected to resume operation by mid-2017. So questions on slide 20?
Yeah, Representative Sponholz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you describe what the failure in the test phase was?
My understanding through the chair is it had to do with, you know, coal dust and the feeding mechanism into the boiler and a resulting fire and explosion from that.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Pickett, I think the question was referring to the 1999 failure.
There was actually an explosion in 1999 here.
Oh, okay, I thought it was just not clean. I thought it was just not as clean as they wanted. Okay. So.
Okay, thank you.
Got a history of explosions. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a matter of curiosity, is if I remember right, that coal was ground to a fine powder and then ignited. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, all right. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Klayman.
Thank you. In between... This is about 20. In between 1999 and the commissioning test in March of 2016, has there been a time when it was running and generating power?
No.
So actually this dormancy phase is ongoing today?
Investment of the state, the feds, and the utility that didn't generate any power.
And follow up through the chair. The expected to resume operation is really the resume operation from back in the 90s.
Well, when you say resume operation, they've done a lot of work. Golden Valley's done a lot of work on this plant. And this is resuming operation from the incident they had in 2016, in March of 2016.
But follow up, in terms of generating energy, there still hasn't been any energy generated, at least that goes onto the grid since the 90s.
Well, no. Let me clarify that. There is... Healy Unit 1 that has consistently been generating 25 megawatts of coal-fired electric generation during the whole period. Healy 2 is adjacent to that, and that's been the part that has not been generating consistently.
Follow up, Representative Klayman.
With regard to Unit 2, though, has it generated any energy between the... This is just Unit 2, not Unit 1. Has it generated any energy between the failure in 1999 and today?
No, not any significant energy. I mean, they just had some testing when they're trying to commission it, but not consistent commercial power.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question, and all these other power generation units, plants that list how many megawatts and how many dollars, it seems to be a somewhat consistent ratio. And then this one came along in 1989 for $400 million with a 50 megawatt capacity. Is that because it was new technology, clean coal technology was new, and this is sort of a prototype?
I think, you know, that the initial CapEx was influenced by the clean coal technology, but the other thing you have to realize is Golden Valley, to get agreement of the state DEC and EPA, had to enter into a consent decree to increase, emission control and bring it up to the latest standards and all of that kind of stuff.
Okay, and my other question would be the new power plant that they're building at the university, which also uses clean coal, is this sort of on the same, is the technology similar to Healy 2, or is it a new generation?
That is being run by the university, is my understanding, and I'm not sure of the technology of that.
So that
they're going to have to have state-of-the-art just in terms of emissions and efficiency and all of that to make sense.
And a follow-up would be, does that power plant fall under your jurisdiction, the new power?
The university does not.
Okay, thank you.
Any more questions on slide 20? We will now move to slide 21, which is the Alaska Environmental Power, or AEP, wind farm down by the junction. It's two 900 kilowatt wind turbines and 100 kilowatt turbine, and it sells 2 megawatts to Golden Valley over the past 6 years, roughly. This had a cost of $8.3 million with a grant from aid of $6.3 million, matching $2 million. So any questions on the AEP wind farm? Hearing none, I'll move on to slide 22. This is the Fire Island wind farm that you see when you land at the Anchorage International Airport. And Fire Island Wind LLC owns and operates a 17.6 megawatt turbine. This began in the fall of 2012, and they have a long-term power purchase agreement with Chugach Electric. They're providing a flat net price of $97 a megawatt hour. And this was a contract that the commission had to look at and consider and approve. Questions on slide 22?
Yeah, I have a question. Is this power that produced there, is it being utilized? Is all its capacity being consumed?
I can't say that all capacity, because the challenge with intermittent and variable renewables is timing and what else is going on with the system. I think, and that's probably a question that would be better put to Representative Chugach, but it is, by and large being utilized. There is a submarine cable connecting the island to the Chugach system, and it seems like it's performing as it was expected to perform, largely.
Thank you.
Moving on to slide 23, I'm moving off the rail belt just a little bit because I do think it's important to give attention to other areas of the state. The rail belt has consumed a lot of the attention because there's been an almost $1.7 billion in generation investment over the last 6 years or so, and this is having an impact on ratepayers up and down the rail belt to incorporate all these capex expenses into rates. The offsetting part of that, though, is this new generation is incredibly more efficient than the old generation in terms of how much natural gas is consumed. And those represent real savings for that part of the customer's electric bill. So we'll get into that a little bit later when we discuss the pipe cooling demonstration that the three of the utilities are doing, but I would like to go to Southeast just a little bit here and talk about Alaska Electric Lightning Power, which has the very first CPCN that the commission issued, and they serve largely the Juneau area and a little bit over on Douglas Island with 16,300 customers. Their most recent significant generation increment that they added was the Lake Dorothy project, and you'll see a map there on slide 24, which shows how it connects into the system down there and the submarine cables. On the lower right-hand part of that slide is transmission from the Snettisham project, which was an old Federal Power project and has been purchasing, AELMP has been purchasing power from that and has rights to that for a number of years. And this is the section of the transmission that you may remember 6 years ago was taken down a couple of times by avalanches. And I would commend the utility for their response to that. It was very professional. It did impact the general rate payer significantly for a short period of time, but they did a very good job in responding to that. Any questions on slide 24?
Yeah, I have one.
Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, I'd like to thank you, through the Chair. I'd just like to go back to slide 22 there. Well, yeah, you have your slide, but Fire Island, what's the total cost we've spent out there so far?
What was the cost on Fire Island?
Yes.
Oh, I think that was roughly, it had a combination of federal tax credits. The state of Alaska itself put about $25 million into the submarine cable connecting the island to the Chugach system, and I seem to remember it was about $50 million plus or minus. Yeah, I think it was $54 million.
So 75? 79? 79 million?
If you include the submarine cable.
Okay, thank you.
A grant from the state to help the island up.
All right, thank you very much.
And back to slide 24, are there any more questions on slide 24? Hearing none, I'll go to slide 25. That gives you some more detailed information with the capacity of 14.3 megawatts, $70 million cost, and some technical details on the elevation of the dam, the lake itself, and the taps and the outlets, and a description of the powerhouse, and the transmission line to connect to the rest of the system was about $3.5 million. And it was roughly an 11-year process from permitting to beginning construction. Questions on slide 25? Hearing none, I will move on to slide 26. This is the Alaska Power Company, or APC, CPCN number 2, and they have a little over 7,000 customers, and they have a very sprawling service area. If you go to slide 27, it gives you a bit of an idea as to the extent of their service area and the small, very rural communities that they do serve. And because of the dispersed nature and different character of these various communities, they have established a number of different rate centers and tried to aggregate the communities in a fashion that makes sense and doesn't, greatly violate cost cause or cost payer principles. Any questions on slide 27?
No.
Slide 28 is the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, or ABEC, with CPCN 169, and they serve 11,000 customers in 57 villages. And just by way of clarification, they are a cooperative, as their name implies. We do not economically regulate AVAC. But we work very closely with AVAC in terms of the power cost equalization program, and as they have acquired various smaller electric utilities, have tried to help in that process. They absorb those CPCNs. Any questions on this?
Yeah, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at slide 28, Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, and I was wondering, is that, I don't know, some of those may be connected, but is that, that's mostly, you know, small diesel generation, or is it all diesel generators?
It is mostly small, through the chair, it is mostly small diesel generation, though they have done incorporate renewables whenever they could get the appropriate grant funding or financing mechanism to put the renewables in place, and then they, you know, try to integrate it into the rest of the system. And it's challenging. I mean, to integrate diesel with a very intermittent and variable renewable is a challenge, and the University of Alaska Fairbanks has done a lot of research on that, and they've worked with AVAC to try to come up with good solutions for that. But diesel is the predominant fuel source.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks. So, Mr. Pickett, based looking at this map, obviously there's such a wide geographic area. I mean, they talk about bulk fuel buying and such, but is a lot of this this cooperative, is it a lot of it administratively connected and
yes,
not much else?
Well, no, I wouldn't say that, because I mean, you know, once they are responsible for the generation assets, they have to have a program in place to make sure those assets are maintained, replaced when necessary. So it's more than just, you know, paper pushing. But, you know, the administrative efficiencies that an entity like AVAC can bring to the table, I think, are significant, because you can't overestimate the impact on a small village of 200 to 300 people on running an electric utility and keeping it running 24/7, 365 days a year. And that really stresses and strains a lot of these small communities. And so the value I see an entity like AVAC bringing in is sort of takes part of that burden out, and it rationalizes the system.
Are there other cooperatives? I mean, this serves 57, which is a lot, and it covers a large area. Are there other, any other type of cooperatives that maybe serve? Well, you had one on the previous page as well, but
yeah, there's more. I mean, you have an electric co-op on Kodiak Island and Costa Mesa co-op, but they tend to be, you know, sort of focused on a particular community.
Okay, thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just have one more question on this slide. So do you have, like, this is a cooperative, but do you have, like, other villages in here? Many, do they have their local government, like their city government, running their power generation?
Yeah, you see, through the chair, Representative Johnson, you see all different approaches to this. I mean, sometimes it's almost a hybrid tribal city government type of operation. Sometimes it's, you know, really just an individual or a family that's trying to keep the lights on out there and just doing what they can do to keep electric power flowing.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Westlake.
Thank you. I'm through the chair. I appreciate what you're saying, and I can speak very comfortably. I've worked with AVAC a lot. Besides the administrative capacity that comes in is the technical abilities. A lot of times you'll have a circuit rider that's out there out of Anchorage or Fairbanks, wherever the case may be, getting out there and having a standardization. So you get those, and then in turn you also have the memorandum of agreements between, say, an AVAC and a Cosby Electric Association, where they've got a team right there in the region. They get out there and do that. As for being able to help on the costs over there, a lot of the villages, yes, they do that. They step up and they pay for supplementing the income in there, because they're trying to keep the cost down. And it's a very daunting task when you've got 57 villages out there. And this is been working well for us. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Westlake, that is an excellent comment, and I don't think you can underestimate how much work AVAC and its partners do mm-hmm. to, you know, keep the lights on in rural Alaska. Mm-hmm. We see it from the filing of the Power Cost Equalization Program, and some of these extremely small communities have a very difficult time just filling out some pretty basic financial paperwork. And that's where an entity like AVAC can really step up to the plate and make sure they don't get disqualified from the PCE program. Are there any more questions on slide 28?
No, I think we're good.
Slide 29 puts some numbers to it, and they've been AVAC has been working in rural Alaska since 1968, and they sold 113 million kilowatt hours in 2015 with revenues of 58 million in 15 and margins of about 3.9 million. And 4% of their power was from wind turbines in 2015. So you can see the overwhelming amount is still diesel generation. Any questions on slide 29?
Nope.
We go to slide 30. This is Inside Passage Electric Cooperative Pipeback, CPC and 240, with 1,072 customers. And Jody Mitchell, who is the CEO, emailed me late yesterday. A lot of this information was taken off annual reports, and she asked me to correct and supplement the record a little bit. And you can see the description of the four communities, but she wanted me to stress that Inside Passage Electric Cooperative has 1,340 members in five rural southeast communities, Angoon, Puna, Cape, Klukwan, and Chilkat Valley, 10 miles in highway to the border. And furthermore, Klukwan and Chilkat Valley are about 100% hydro, but the other three communities are primarily diesel. And they completed a small hydro in 2015 in Huna, which carries about 32% of Huna's load. And they've identified at least three potential hydro projects which would decrease diesel dependency significantly. So if anyone sees Jody, tell her I corrected the slide.
Thank you.
Any more questions on slide 30? We're now going to move back to the rail belt, and I'll give just a little bit of background information. The legislature, over a number of years, and I would say dating even back to the late 90s, has been somewhat concerned and at times extremely frustrated with what they saw to be the intensely balkanized and fragmented rail belt electrical system and how it sort of historically has developed. In the late 90s, at the time deregulation was sweeping the lower 48, there was a study done that looked at potential restructuring of the Alaska electric marketplace. And it was decided that the market was too small to really effectively go down that path. In 2006 or so, legislative recommendations to give you a little bit of background and context. In 2006, the legislature appropriated about $800,000 to the Alaska Energy Authority to do a rail belt electric grid authority study, and they hired Black & Veatch, and this process went on for a couple of years and came out with some findings that there were things that could be done to, you know, perhaps rationalize the grid. And the outcome of that was there was specific legislation called BREPSI in 2008, 2009, and 2010. That was trying to push unification of the grid. That effort ultimately failed, and nothing really came out of it. But at the same time, the legislative frustration continued with what they perceived to be squabbling. And so in 2014, at the conclusion of that legislative session, the legislature directed the commission to take a new look at the grid and the structure of the electric system in the rail belt. This is the focus. And come back a year later with specific findings and recommendations. And I believe you do have that six-page letter in your packet. And I'll go through and highlight the findings and the recommendations, and then it would probably be appropriate to get into a little bit more detailed discussion on some of the aspects of that. So we submitted our letter to the legislature June 30th, 2015. And our first finding was, had a couple of components to it and some assumptions built into it. And that was the rail belt system requires institutional reform. And legacy purchase power agreements had historically kind of limited some of the efficiencies. And we also at that time made an assumption that given the conditions in the state, it was not realistic to expect any significant state funding would be available for this effort. And so our recommendations were for the utilities to look at creating an independent transmission company, an ITC, and regulate the certificate under our statute 4205. We laid forth some timelines because I believe the way the commission was looking at this, utilities know their business. They know how they operate their respective systems within their certificated boundaries. But what we saw was sometimes there was a bit of a gap in coordination and cooperation and things like that. But largely they do cooperate. And so we laid out some mandatory reports with the inference that it makes sense to give you the opportunity to voluntarily come up with a solution, and then if that effort fails or is perceived to not be making any progress by the commission, then we'll have to take a look and see if we should be using any regulatory authority we have to promote that, which there is controversy as to how far that authority goes. We won't actually work with the administration and the legislature to see the specific statutory changes. So that was, you know, at the heart of finding and recommendation number one and some of the philosophy thinking behind it. Number two.
I have a question on yeah. Number one. In your letter, it also has a sentence that the RCA should be granted siting authority for new generation and transmission.
We'll get into that recommendation a little bit later, sort of what that actually means.
Okay. If you want to go to number two, that was the one of recommendation number one. And needless to say, the reports have been filed as was requested.
As was requested, that's correct. But you see, with recommendation number one through the chair, they did file those reports, but through 16, with this independent transmission company, we are aware of fairly extensive negotiations and system modeling that has been going on consistently since this report. And we're anticipating some sort of filing this spring, and if we don't see it by, say, April or May, we will order a filing on that. But we didn't feel it was appropriate for us to jump in the middle of commercial negotiations like that and give it a chance to see what develops.
And you say that's with an independent transmission company?
That's correct.
Okay. All right, I'll let you carry on.
I will move on to, I'm on slide 31 to deal with the summarization of the findings and recommendations on finding number two. Dispatch does not occur on a system-wide basis. Every utility historically dispatches based on their own generation and load portfolios, which when we looked at how much ratepayer money has been invested in new generation, and as I said, it's approaching $1.7 billion, and it's much more efficient. Though different generation units have different generation characteristics and efficiencies, we thought it was very important to move towards what in the industry is called merit order economic dispatch. At any given point in time, you essentially have a stack of generation, and the most efficient generation is operating first, and then you go down to the, you know, just go down the stack, which has commercial complications for the utilities to on the settlement process, and, you know, since we're not a fully restructured market at all, that kind of gets down to what we'll talk about in the power cooling filing that we saw, but I'll leave that for just a little bit later. Until we get the merit order economic dispatch in some form, the ratepayers are not going to realize the maximum benefits from this new efficient generation, and that's the bottom line.
We have a question from Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have a question on the, and you may be getting to it later, so, but is there a basically a dispatching system that that you've identified as working well for the rail belt power companies, and do you have an approximate price on what that system would cost?
There's many forms that can take. I mean, there's already balancing areas in which utilities cooperate. You know, for example, in Anchorage, QDEC and MLNP and MEA have cooperated on just making sure the lights stay on. What I'm talking about is a little bit higher level of economic dispatching to make sure that not only do the lights stay on and the system stays reliable, but you're realizing the maximum economic benefits from dispatching, and that's a higher level of complication.
Okay. Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and I'm kind of familiar with that, and so I guess that higher level would take maybe a more sophisticated approach. And do you have? I mean, are we going to talk about, or do you have any kind of sense of how that kind of dispatching would? I mean, if there's some kind of mechanism that.
Well,
how much of a cost?
Through the chair, I think the type cooling agreement that was filed on sort of this interim informational basis, they're still trying to work the bugs out and get the commercial agreements in place to where they feel confident that this is something ready to be totally rolled out. And the primary metric they're using is fuel savings, which I think makes sense. Because if you look at how other markets are organized, for example, ERCOT in Texas or MISO in the Midwest or PJM in the East, they operate at such a level of complexity it would be totally inappropriate for us to try to replicate that up here. We have to realize we've got a very small system, and we need to design something that's appropriate for this system, yet at the same time squeezes some of the benefits that are out there out of it.
Okay, thank you.
So, continuing with finding two, I'm still on slide 31. Key principles are non-discriminatory access to the grid, transparent pricing, and dispatching from an independent entity. Recommendation number two, we stated that system-wide merit order economic dispatch was the way you're going to bring the maximum benefit to the ratepayers. We encourage, as an interim step, a loose power pool, which sort of happens, you know, on the economy energy cells, but the type pool is a move a little bit farther down that spectrum. And we ask that they file with the commission quarterly the voluntary power pooling strategies and quarterly reports with us, which they have been doing. So before I move on to slide 32, are there any more questions on slide 31? Hearing none, slide 32 on finding number three. I'm going to be honest with the committee. This is probably the one we got the most pushback from the utilities, and they didn't exactly like how we phrased it that we thought it was accurate. And the finding was that many past efforts to reform have failed, and there's a lot of skepticism about the electric utility's ability to voluntarily reform the grid on their own. And reliance on state appropriations and a lack of trust have created a somewhat dysfunctional history. And the follow-up on the recommendation to number three was a statement that history indicates that current voluntary transmission restructuring may fail. And the failure of the voluntary efforts and initiatives will trigger compulsory action by the commission. We did not state specifically what that was going to be, because that is going to depend upon what ultimately is our the extent of our regulatory authority, and what, in the event that statutory changes are necessary, would the administration and legislature be willing to do.
Mr. Pickett, how long has this this problem been addressed for? In other words, the economic dispatch and unification of the grid. How many years has this problem been worked on, looked at?
How many years has the problem been looked at? I'd say at least 20.
Okay.
At least 20.
Okay, thanks. I've heard they're just about to happen, so I appreciate that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
We have a question, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I was just wondering, certainly it's been talked about for a long time, you know, on a variety of factors, but would you say that there's a bright spot in the middle of our dysfunction, that maybe it's moving in the right direction? I mean, I guess I'd like to hear that.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I would say yes. They have made progress. It is slow at times, but I don't want to sound like a broken record. The level of complexity with these various things, and we cannot discount the history as to how we got here. And at the same time, they're responsible. They're trying to absorb this new generation into their rate base and incorporate it into rates. It's a tremendous amount of work to do that and the associated depreciation studies. So there's a lot of things that are happening at the same time. But having said that, they're still working together, trying to push the ball forward. And that's part of the reason I think the commission has been willing to let the voluntary efforts continue to play out, with the idea that we're continuing to watch it and keep the pressure on and keep us informed. So I would say yes, there is a bright spot.
Thank you.
I have another question, Mr. Pickett. This is the chair. And that is, you said it's been 20 years. Obviously, there's been a lot of new generation, power generation, that's been online since then. And the lack of siting authority, and maybe we'll get to that question later, I know. But in other words, if obviously a lot of stuff's happened in 20 years that's changed the equation. So,
Siting authority in terms of, through the chair, siting authority in terms of generation in place right now is not going to impact that. That's a done deal at this stage, short of improvements findings or something like that. Where it is going to come into play is if there is, in fact, major transmission upgrades with significant projects, that's an area where siting authority probably should be concerned. I don't think siting authority, utility management, has to have the discretion to make decisions on a lot of stuff. I don't think anyone on the commission wants siting authority where you put every meter or distribution power pole. We absolutely do not want that. But on major projects where you're talking about in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and it's going to go into rates, I think that's something that should definitely be considered.
Okay. Thank you. I'll let you go on.
I'm still on slide 32, finding number four. At this point in time, there are no mandatory electric reliability standards that are articulated in the form, say, you have outside with the NERC, the National Electric Reliability Council, and the various local, like the Texas Reliability Entity or the other reliability entities across the country. We're non-FERC jurisdictional. And there are voluntary standards that the utilities have developed, but they have not all adopted the same standards. There is an intertide management committee that was created in, that includes Chugach Electric, Golden Valley, Matanuska Electric, and Municipal Light and Power. And AGA did adopt the modified version of the reliability standards in the rail belt. It's our understanding utilities are trying to work out the differences and distinctions between that. But one of the challenges, and it is discussed in recommendation number 4 on the right side of the panel, is at this point in time, they're voluntary standards, and there's no enforceable and consistent rail belt operation and reliability standards. We believe they are necessary. The problem with voluntary standards is if I as a utility will say I'm going to voluntarily comply until such time that it is inconvenient or I just don't want to comply for a variety of reasons, the standard sort of loses its impact. And so we believe there does need to be a common rail belt operating and reliability standard. And we did strongly encourage the Intercom Management Committee and Homer Electric to resolve their differences. And we will be pushing at a public meeting either in April or May the reliability issue. They need to address critical infrastructure standards. Cybersecurity is a huge concern. And I will say that 5 of the rail belt communities have voluntarily cooperated with the commission and some resources from Homeland Security to look at some of the assessment things. So they're aware of it, and I think they're operating in good faith. And it's just the big question mark is what is the enforcement mechanism going to be? So any questions on finding number 4 and recommendation number 4?
Nope.
We'll need to move on to slide 33 with the finding, and this is more focused upon the impact as all this these recommendations and findings unfold. First finding in number 5 was implementing the first 4 findings is going to be very challenging and time-consuming, and we're estimating full implementation of the proposed system structural changes will take 5 to 10 years to do that. And many parties from many different areas are going to have to cooperate on this. This not only includes the utilities, but the energy authority, the commission, and the legislature and administration are going to have to be on the same page for this to actually move forward. We believe, concerning recommendation number 5, the initial steps, and I would say that includes to where we're at today, we can incorporate it in our current funding structure. We do not receive general funds. We're funded by regulatory cost charges, which are an assessment upon individual ratepayers' bills. And since this is related directly to the industries we regulate, we believe that, to date and probably, going forward for another year or so, or 2 years, we'll be able to keep this process moving. But if it gets to the point where significant changes and we're having a lot of demands on our staff, well, we just don't have the staff to deal with it. We need outside assistance. We're going to have to look at what the options are.
We have a question from Representative Johnston.
So thank you very much for getting this far in your PowerPoint. So the elephants in the room, or would you consider the elephants in the room, is first of all your fixed capital costs that each of these utilities have incurred as far as their power generation, number one. The cost, the variable cost of that power generation depending on the fuel and the efficiency of their new plants and their old plants. And 3, the transmission lines and the need to update, since some of these transmission lines are meeting the end of their life. And the 4th most important one is having some adult in the room getting all the wheels in the bus to go in the same direction.
through the chair, I generally agree with, you know, sort of how you characterize it, but I do want to stress the fact that I do believe the utilities, the management and their boards have been acting in good faith and acting as adults and moving the ball forward. As I said, when you look at the last 20 or 30 years, it's easy to get extremely frustrated. But I do think that things are moving in the right direction at this point in time.
Thank you.
As far as the capital expenditures, those are going to be incorporated into rates upon appropriate review and, you know, through a rate case and depreciation studies, short of any improvements kind of fine. Our statutes are structured in a way that once the utility makes an investment, the commission is obligated to set rates at a level that they're able to pay for that investment.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on that note, when you do a rate review on what other capital expense, operating expense, so on, request, I guess, at the request of the utility, about how long does that process take from initiation to determination?
We have statutory deadlines, and we have to complete stuff within 15 months.
Okay.
If it's not a contested case and you don't have a lot of interveners, it can't happen shorter than that. It's like a full-blown litigation case because you have discovery process, you have the rights of the parties, and you also have the hearing.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have a question, Mr. Pickett. You said that the utilities are acting in good faith. Now, do you see much of this happening since your letter, your finding and recommendation document here that we have? In other words, did that sort of spur them along?
You would have to ask the utilities themselves, but I do think it's been a fraud, and they know we're not going away, and they know we're considering to look at it, and they don't want us in the absence of any action, taking unilateral action, which we don't want to do either.
Okay, thank you. Representative Westlake.
Yes, and through the chair, thank you. We're looking at all these commission findings and recommendations out here, and you see some where the past efforts to reform have failed. You've got some system incompatibility there. And I'm always hesitant to get into the local level. There may be a reason that the things are not working, that they won't integrate. Is there something like that where maybe someone's got older equipment, or what's the issue? Why are we running this recommendation is to basically interject ourselves into this?
Through the chair, we are looking at it from the system-wide efficiency. You're correct. I mean, there are a variety of reasons. There's a lot of history why things happen the way they happen. But at the end of the day, I think it's our responsibility to make sure the system is operating in a fashion that brings the maximum economic benefits to the ratepayers, because they are the ones paying for it. It's not the utility. The ratepayers are paying for it. And they're the ones that are entitled to reliable electric utility service. And I think all the utility executives, you know, they want a reliable system. And I think that there have been changes with, you know, various positions with the utility executives and different ways of sort of looking at things. That, as I said earlier, I'm encouraged by the positive direction things are taking.
Thank you.
So, anything else on slide 33? I'll try to.
Nope, no questions there.
Get through the rest of them here.
Yeah, and as you know, we have some questions. So, at some point.
You rather go to the questions. And
well, why don't you do this next slide on the unified system operator and Transco, and then maybe we can jump to some questions.
Sure. What this does is just distinguishes what the USO or Unified System Operator is, the distinction with an independent system operator, and a Transco, what they actually do. And they aren't hard lines, because you see hybrid types of structures that incorporate the aspects and sort of combine it with another. So I will just leave that slide to speak for what it is. And through the chair, I do have the list of, it looks like about 9 questions that Rob forwarded to me yesterday afternoon. Would you want me to go through those first and just open it up to the committee?
Well, I don't know if the committee has any more questions. Oh, the committee doesn't have the questions. Okay. So we'll have to read them, I guess. And
okay. Well,
I'm happy to ask you them, and then you can answer them. How's that? I mean, you have them as well, but I'll...
That's fine. Let's do that.
Okay. Well, the first one is about the Beluga power plant, and is it costing the rail belt money? Now that there's new natural gas generation, will it be time to stop paying to keep old gas plants like Beluga operational and instead retire them?
You know, utility managers generally have the right to decide when specific assets are retired or not. Now, we can specifically require certain actions given the appropriate due process rights and all of that. But to do so, we have to find that the utility has engaged in unreasonable management practices that have an adverse effect on the cost or quality of service. And the question, embedded in that question, is the assumption that retirement would save the rail belt consumers money, which may or may not be true depending on the asset lives and salvage values and costs. And, you know, for example, in Beluga, each of those plants has a different retirement date and a certain lifespan left. And so as assets are depreciated, a certain amount of that increment goes out of rate base, and they do not earn any sort of return on it anymore, or margin in the case of co-ops. And in the case, for example, of Chugach, when you actually get to the point of retiring the asset, their depreciation studies have shown they actually have a negative asset value, meaning when you totally take the thing offline and retire it officially, it could conceivably increase rates in the short run. Now, to date, they're keeping the Beluga assets until the rest of this rail belt system reorganization efforts is settling down as something that is, you know, kind of providing peaking generation. It does have possible black start aspects to the system, though there's some disagreement with different utilities as to the value of what that is. And there is a potential bar support in the transmission lines. And again, this gets into a lot of technical areas that there are differences of opinion as to how that plays out.
Okay. The next question is about, I guess, the timetable of the rail belt utilities as far as forming a unified system, and that the power pooling agreement that was reached recently is a good step, as you mentioned. And you see some good faith effort. Is there a timeline? Is there sort of at what point will you determine that the voluntary efforts for a system-wide operator failed?
What we've tried to do is to incentivize and facilitate cooperation with these interconnected utilities in the rail belt. And there's not really specific mandatory criteria with how this is going to be accomplished, because at times it's a little bit of a, you know, circumstances change, and so the response has to change a little bit. And, you know, it's not defined as to what constitutes a failure. And I think it's fair for me to say the Commission believes that a voluntary, cooperative, collaborative process is not a failure until the parties get to an impasse and activities just stop. And we're seeing no evidence of that in any of these areas. I will say, however, I am going to be bringing the reliability standards to the forefront in April and May, and because we're probably not seeing the same level of movement with that recommendation as with the others, so that will be happening.
Okay. Well, in my short time, as you mentioned earlier, the legislature asked you to do a report, and that was in 2014, and you guys produced a document in 2015, and there's been some activity from the utilities in January of 2017, I guess that was, and I don't know when the power pooling happened in January, so it seems like there has been some movement, and maybe it was spurned by activity from the legislature and then activity from the RCA, so we'll certainly keep a close eye on it. Next question is next question is about siting authority, which basically is the RCA having the authority to about new power and transmission construction, and as was stated earlier, if the RCA had siting authority years ago, then maybe all this power generation that's been constructed recently would have been done differently. So what are your thoughts on that? And in your letter, you obviously requested it. So, you know, how important is this? And what are your thoughts on, did you ever have siting authority?
We had to have our attorney general research that, and his response was, and I'll just read what he provided to me. Anecdotally, the Public Service Commission, which was the precursor organization of the RCA, had limited siting authority prior to 1970. He was not able to specifically locate the text of that statute, however, and he also goes on to state the pre-1970 period is not comparable because the Public Service Commission did not have certificate authority over political subdivisions. Now that the political subdivisions, even those that are exempt under 4205-711B, now have certificates, siting authority over both generation and transmission can be exercised through the CPCN or making of that. And he cites the example of the Alaska Environmental Power. And so CPCN power and authority can be a bit of a, how do I put this diplomatically, blunt instrument. A siting authority statute could be a little better for fine-tuning stuff, but I think that the caveat with siting authority is there would need to be limitations on this, because as I stated earlier, utility managers have to be able to make the decisions they make on their investment. And I don't think the commission wants to get down to a granular level, and there was another state report that recently came out and suggested we could have siting authority on pretty much every activity these small rural electric companies have, and that is something that I would be cautious about.
Okay.
The devil's in the details.
All right. Well, as you stated earlier, if it's hundreds of millions of dollars, or if they were going to upgrade the transmission lines of $900 million estimate or something, That'd be an appropriate use of siting authority, yeah. We have a question from Representative Rauscher.
A brief time out.
A brief face?
Yeah.
Take a
Okay.
And we just have a few more minutes, so I'll try to get through these questions. But I also want to thank you very much for testifying today, Mr. Pickett, and your associates, James Lane and Bernie Smith, too. Thank you, because it's been a long time coming, and we'll probably have more questions for you later. So I'll get back to these few remaining questions that I have, if we can get to all of them. So we finish up on siting authority. Access to the grid by independent power producers. Obviously, the goal of a unified system is to have a single rate that anyone can use the transmission, and we can move power around the rail belt as needed. There's a tight power pool right now in the Anchorage area with the three municipalities. Is there a single rate right now, or tariff created if a IPP wants to get onto that system? And if not, when will that happen?
There are tariffs for transmission on the books of the respective utilities at this point. And that's one of the challenges that, say, a small power producer, if you had to go over several utilities transmission systems, you encounter what is called pancaking rates, meaning they just keep adding up. And that was one of the, I think, considerations in recommending the establishment of some sort of a Transco to try to rationalize it on a rail belt-wide basis. Now, an independent power producer, if they want to interconnect with a particular utility and provide service in the location that that utility is located, they have to negotiate with that utility. A transmission tariff does not just automatically give them access to the system. It's either got to be a tariff rate that they accept on maybe a kilowatt hour or something of that. And a lot of the IPPs have needed longer-term power purchase agreements to be able to pull the financing and funding package together. A QF, which is a creation of PURPA, may have rights to interconnect if the utilities tariff permits it, but a non-QF really has no rights to sell or transmit power to the customers or public utilities unless itself has a certificate of public convenience and necessity or is exempt from that particular requirement. And the point I'm going to stress is under existing law, no customer or utility is obligated to buy from an IPP, independent power producer, or even consider power purchases from an IPP except by contract. So the way the statute is set up is that is a negotiated thing between the IPP and the utility.
Okay, thank you. But that, in a unified system, that would be a different, that would change.
I couldn't really speculate as to the exact form.
Right.
But if you have some sort of unified system or unified transmission, everybody is going to have the same access to the system subject to the tariff to be developed.
Okay.
It would be a level playing field.
Let's see, and the next question has to do with ISO versus USO, which you touched upon a little bit, which is independent system operator versus unified system operator. And I was on this committee the last 2 years when we had a lot of testimony on this issue, and I don't think anyone else on the committee now is here except Representative Klayman, who's not presently in the room. But we talked to other ISOs from different parts of the country, and I think we had some other parties come in. Are you concerned about the independence of an ISO as opposed to a USO, which may be controlled by the utilities?
To the chair, I'm just stating my personal opinion. Whatever entity is created could take on a number of different forms or aspects. Perhaps it would be looked at as a sort of hybrid. I do think the key is in governance. You know, how is this entity going to be governed and who should be represented on it? I don't think it's appropriate for the governance structure to just exclusively be utilities. I think other voices do need to be involved with this. But by the same token, if the assets being pledged to this entity or the capital being raised by this entity are going to need some assurances that the created entity is going to behave in an economically rational fashion and protect the investments.
We have a question from Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm trying to think if there's any other entity out there that's operates somewhat similarly that we could use to model for. I've heard different versions of how this might get put together, but I was trying to think of some other. Do we have anything else out there that you've looked at that might be something to model after?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, that's been one of the main things I've been doing for the last 3 years. I've spent a lot of time with representatives of ERCOT in Houston and Austin and people who were present at the formation of ERCOT. I've dealt with a lot of people with MISO, the Midwest Integrated System Operator, and sort of how that works in the relationship to the respective individual states. We're kind of unique in that we're not crossing state boundaries, and one of the gentlemen in Houston, this would have been a couple years ago, he could see my head was just about ready to explode, considering all the options. And he looked at me and he said, "You do have one real distinct advantage." And I said, "John, what on earth is that?" And he said, "You don't have to make the same mistakes we made. You actually have the ability to sort of look at what worked in ERCOT and maybe what works in MISO or PJM or the Western Interconnect and see what makes sense for Alaska to take those aspects. Many of these systems are so incredibly complicated, it would be gross overkill for what we need up here."
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's see. The next question has a similar type of question. Instead of ISO, USO, it would be the Transco in the USO, and the Transco is the transmission company, and there's talk of a separate entity who sort of owns the transmission infrastructure, and then you'd have a system operator that dispatches. Would or unified system operator that dispatches. And do you see a blurring of that line between the company that owns the transmission and the company that dispatches it as being, should that be a separation? And you mentioned that there is some talk right now with a Transco, or was that a, you said they are talking right now with, yeah.
And talking to a number of the utilities, Mr. Chair. Yes, I do think you may see a blurring of the lines, and just exactly how that form will take shape, I cannot say definitively at this point, and I'm not sure that they could either, because it's a process with various utilities and trying to negotiate, and ultimately at some point, it's going to involve the state of Alaska and its transmission assets. And so the state is, in all likelihood, going to have some involvement and a seat at the table as far as how this whole thing shakes out.
Okay. Let's see, I just got a few more. We just got a few minutes left. The cost estimate for the upgrade was $900 million some years ago, and that included tying in Susitna-Wautauna Dam. That is no longer in the plan, but the cost estimate is about the same. Is that accurate, or am I... is there a new estimate?
Not exactly. That study you're referring to by the electric power systems had two big pieces to it. There was the Crewe-Wautauna study, which is the $900 million, and then there was another component to that called the post-Wautauna. Assuming the dam came online, what else would you need to do? Now, the $900 million, we had a presentation on that a couple of years ago at the commission, and we certainly have not embraced that at all as far as the number or any prioritization or anything like that. And in fact, we raised some questions about some internal assumptions within that particular study that have ultimately been dealt with, but it's somewhat skewed the cost-benefit ratio. I think it has identified projects that definitely need to be considered, but the update to this is my understanding that they have not included a dollar figure for the cost of the upgrades, and we have not seen any sort of presentation before the commission at a public meeting on this updated study. And that's something that, would make sense for the commission to have some level or type of siting authority as these big pieces of CapEx on transmission come into play.
Okay. We're about over, I guess. There's a few more questions. I can't get to them all. I'll just ask the last one. Having to do with Bradley Lake, it says, does the state play a role in the management of this facility? I think I know the answer to that. And who paid for Bradley Lake? And also, are the bonds due to be paid off in the next few years? And when they are paid off, is there an annual payment that the participating utilities must make back into the state rail belt energy fund? sort of combine two questions into one, but your last swipe at it.
Yeah, through the chair, as I stated earlier, and I think we had a slide on that, the commission does not have regulatory authority over Bradley Lake. In fact, we have been specifically excluded from that. And in fact, one of the parties in the recent litigation suggested that we didn't even have the right to meet the Bradley Lake agreement. So, which we don't agree with that, but
right.
That's something that you'll have to talk to the appropriate parties at the Alaska Energy Authority and the Bradley Lake Management Committee. It is my understanding the bonds are nearing being paid off, and what's going to happen after that, I couldn't tell you.
Okay. One last little question. What does CPCN stand for? That was on some of your slides, and I forgot to ask earlier.
I'm sorry. It's the Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity.
Okay.
In essence, it's the license for the utility to do business.
Okay. And we have one last question from Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to go back to the boundaries again of the rail, what the rail belt consists of. And I'm sorry it's at the very end here, but I see that there's areas on the western side of Cook Inlet. Is that considered rail belt area because that's part of the borough of Kenai borough and Matsu borough?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, that's the Beluga power plant area.
And that actually gets served by Beluga?
Yeah, it serves some small, a few places, and I think at Kionic maybe for Adams and Beluga, and that's part of Chugach's area there.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Well, once again, Mr. Pickett, I want to thank you very much for your presentation today, and we will stay in touch, I'm sure.
And we'd like to thank you for the opportunity to be before you, and hopefully it has been helpful to you, and feel free to contact us.
Thank you. It's been very helpful. Thank you again. And it's 12:03, and we will adjourn this meeting.